For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, everybody's favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. Gentlemen, 2 years ago, if someone used the word woke, I would have thought, oh, great, you got up in the morning. Today, woke has taken on an entirely new meaning. To some people, it means one thing. To other people, it means another. We really need to see if we can put a pin in this and make sure that we know what people are talking about when we're talking about being woke. And to do that, today we're going to bring up a author and professor, Joshua Mitchell, who has written a new book, American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Now, we're going to jump right into that right after this message, and we'll be back with the Catholic Cave.
No fake news here, just the good news of Jesus Christ as shared through His one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell, and the cave is still Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford, our trusty sidekick. And we are just delighted to welcome Professor Joshua Mitchell into the Catholic Cave. He is a professor of political theory at Georgetown University, great Catholic institution, the author of numerous journal articles and four books, most recently Tocqueville in Arabia. I love that title. We're going to talk about de Tocqueville too, I think. Professor Mitchell's research focuses on Western political philosophy and theology. In 2005, he was part of the team responsible for founding Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in Doha, Qatar, from 2008 to 2010. While on leave from Georgetown, Professor Mitchell served as acting chancellor of the American University of Iraq. He lives on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Well, welcome, Professor Mitchell.
Thank you, Sam and Mark. Good to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you because we've been poring over your most recent book, which is called American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. And I got to tell you, when I read the book, when I saw some other lectures and interviews you gave on this topic, it was really kind of an aha moment. There's something going on in the culture, and I don't know that we can. I wasn't able to really kind of put my finger on it. So you've got some great insights. Could we start with like what's the main theme or themes of your book, American Awakening?
Well, that we're in a very strange moment in American history. America's had a couple of great awakenings, great religious awakenings. And my thesis is that we're in the midst of a strange moment that's like that. But the way I characterize it is that we're in the midst of a great awakening without God and without forgiveness. And what I mean by that is that everywhere you look, people are looking to establish where is purity? Where is stain? You've got this woke culture that's trying to demonstrate to the world that it's pure. It's siding with all the innocent victims. It's trying to identify who the dirty people are, the deplorables. And my argument is this is not politics anymore. This is a religious quest for purity, except that what's been ruled out is the Christian understanding that man is broken and through Christ's sacrifice, we achieve some measure of hope and faith, and I'm not going to say purity, but the brokenness of man is solved by God rather than by purging other groups. And that's what identity politics does, is identifies specific groups of people. In this particular moment, it's the white heterosexual male, and says all the problems are can be traced to him. And if we can just purge him and all the things that he's produced, like the nation state, like capitalism, like dirty fossil fuels, like the patriarchal family, like Christianity, then life will be good and we'll live in a pure world. It's a very twisted moment in American history.
Now, when you're describing all of that, you're describing this as a religion, as sort of a religious movement. You know, you mentioned this is a third great awakening. We've had other great awakenings in American history, and I think when most people think about identity politics, they think of it as a political movement, social movement, started in universities, etc. What is it about this that makes you think of it more in terms of, I guess, religion and religious ideology than politics or sort of social ideology?
So politics and, politics in America is supposed to be and is largely about interests. So it's a conflicting interest groups and the other limits to that. But it's not supposed to be about purity and staying. And there's a great confusion about identity. It's really remarkable. 20 or 30 years ago, I remember this well, nobody used the word identity. We would say, mm-hmm. I'm an American, I'm a this, I'm a that, but we didn't say I had an American identity or I have a heterosexual identity. And now everybody is using the term, and that requires some account. And so people are saying, well, identity is just another word for kind. So I'm an American, that's a kind of citizen. There's Lebanese citizens, and it's just a descriptor of the different kinds of things that are out there. And the left is saying, well, we just want to make sure that all the different kinds, different identities are fairly represented in the United States. That's actually not what's going on, because when you use the term identity today on the left, you're not just describing who you are, you're positioning yourself with respect to others. There's something now that you can research on the internet. It's called intersectionality. And the idea is that you have all of these different sorts of identities that add up. And some people have these mixed identities. So you can be black and gay. You can be Hispanic and lesbian or transgender. And you can actually go to the internet and look up your intersectionality score. And it basically establishes how many guilt and innocence points you have. If you're a white heterosexual male, you basically get no break. You are the prime source here. And if you're a woman, you get a little bit of a break. And if you're black, you get more of a break. This is a very, very twisted understanding of politics. Politics is supposed to be about you and I coming to the table and trying to figure out how we can resolve problems and make compromises. Identity politics is not interested in solving problems. That's why it's not politics. It's really interested in establishing who is pure and who is impure, and then using the resources of the state to distribute goods to the most innocent victims and to take them away from the guilty ones. This is a very, very strange mixing of politics and religion, and I think it's deeply dangerous, largely because in politics you have to establish competence. You have to establish what is the best argument that wins, where the best use of resources might be. And if we didn't have, say, China lurking over our shoulder and threatening to kind of surpass us, that would be one thing. But America has all these challenges, and what we really need to do is to pay attention to what I call liberal competence, or the competence of citizens, rather than their identity category.
What do you think accounts for the shift? Because I'm of the age, so I'm in mid-50s. I remember, like, as you mentioned, Professor, 20, 30 years ago, no one brought up the word identity. What happened to bring about the state of affairs that we have now? Was there some moment, was there some event, or what do you think happened?
So let me give a kind of short range, which is, say, 50, 60-year view, and then a much longer view. First, the short-range view, and I blame this mostly on the Protestants, but I think we can, there's a fair share of blame that can go all around. And look at what's happened to the churches since after World War II, and I'll speak mostly of the mainline Protestant churches, is they've really gone soft. Now, I know this has happened in the Roman Catholic Church as well, but they've really gone soft. They've lost sight of the idea of God's judgment. They've lost sight of the idea of human sin and the need for atonement and repentance. Instead, what you find in the churches these days, especially the Protestant ones, is a kind of feel-good religion where God just loves you, and we've lost sight of judgment, and there's no sense of sin at all. So the question is, did sin completely disappear from American political culture? And my argument is, it left the churches, but it migrated into politics. And so you go to the mainline churches today, and oftentimes the Catholic churches, there's very little conversation about the stain in our hearts because of sin. And you know, Catholics and Protestants have different views of the depth of original sin, and that's fine. But both of them do understand that man can't do it alone. We have to have Christ's gift. Christ's salvation, in order for promise of salvation, in order for us to be pulled up out of the brokenness of human life. And what happened was, as the churches went soft on this, the idea of purity and stain, or the abstain, migrated into politics. And you probably have heard of these Pew Charitable Trust polls in which they try to assess the religiosity of America today. And increasingly, you hear the story that more and more Americans identify as nones, N-O-N-E-S, those who have no religious affiliation. And I suggest that we're asking the wrong question and looking in the wrong place. Americans are still desperately trying to figure out what purity and stain is and how we resolve it. But the churches have gone completely soft on this, and so Americans find their religion, so to speak. They find their way of thinking through purity and stain no longer in the churches, but through identity politics. So this twisted Christianity, which is an accounting of purity and stain and how we move from one to the other, this twisted Christianity has now penetrated into American politics. That's why I call it an American awakening without God and without forgiveness. So that's the immediate cause. That's, in a way, the American cause. It's the softening of culture after World War II. But there's a much deeper cause. And while I'm not a fan of Friedrich Nietzsche, in the 1880s, Friedrich Nietzsche made this remarkable claim. He said that the West would be haunted by this, that you would have this Enlightenment movement that would develop, and it would ostensibly repudiate Christianity. We'd move from religion to philosophy. And this is really what I study at Georgetown, is the Enlightenment movement, and in my view, its links to Christianity. But what Nietzsche said was that this Enlightenment view would carry all the trappings of Christianity, the idea of equality, the idea of the dignity of persons, most importantly, but it would no longer be linked to Christianity. And his argument is that the West would be stuck in this intermediate period where it would be using these Christian categories but without the Christian reference to it. And my argument is that is what identity politics is. It refuses, in fact, it hates Christianity, and yet it's using these Christian categories of the innocent one, and we haven't talked about this, but the scapegoat. If you look at the words that are used by people who believe in identity politics, they'll talk about fascists, Nazis, homophobes, transphobes, misogynists. I mean, these aren't descriptor words. These are scapegoating words. And the brilliance of Christianity is that it recognized that we only achieve some measure of purity, or recover over our stain, to be more theologically precise, through the divine scapegoat. Christ is the divine scapegoat who takes upon himself the sins of the world. This is the central, brilliant insight of Christianity. And it's brilliant, of course, for many reasons, but one is what it means is that then we can't look at other groups and scapegoat them in order for us to be relieved of our burden of stain. And what I'm arguing here is that identity politics is group scapegoating. So when you say the word misogynist, deplorable, fascist, Nazi, you're not simply describing people. You are scapegoating them. You're trying to get them to be completely purged. You want to purge the toxicity from the social body, hence the term toxic masculinity. I mean, this is a religious attempt to purge the impure ones by scapegoating them. That's not politics anymore. You can't get politics done when you're scapegoating people. So what Nietzsche saw, which I think is really quite brilliant, is that we would be haunted by this moment of history, or in this moment of history, because we'd be using these Christian categories, but they would no longer have their Christian reference. And so my argument is the only way this identity politics thing can be fixed is when the churches step forward and say, there is indeed a scapegoat who takes away the sins of the world, but it's not the white heterosexual male. You can't just scapegoat him and solve the problem of the stain in the human heart. It's Christ who takes away the sins of the world. And you can have a Protestant version where it's this direct relationship to Christ, or the Catholic version where the church is the vicegerent of Christ on earth until he returns again. But the point is both the Catholics and Protestants must step forward and say that you are appropriating Christianity here in deeply destructive ways.
Well, we're talking with Professor Joshua Mitchell. That was fantastic. I have a lot of questions. What a great explanation. He's in background. He is the professor of political theory at Georgetown University. He's the author of this fantastic brand new book, American Awakening. That is quite an accounting. Which work of Nietzsche would you say that you're drawing from when you're? Is that his Genealogy of Morals?
Yes, it's in the Genealogy of Morals. I think it's in paragraph 9. You know, I'm paid to know these things. It's in the first essay, paragraph 9. He says, this is what he says, it's the church and not its poison that offends us. And he's talking about we enlightened modern people. So we enlightened modern people, this would be also mostly people on the left, you know, we don't believe in religion anymore. That's just silly. We're enlightened. So the church offends us, but not its poison. That is to say, all of the categories within Christianity, like the scapegoat, like dignity of person. So the whole modern project is an attempt to take from Christianity certain things, put them on an entirely different foundation. And Nietzsche, while he was ultimately anti-Christian, he believed that couldn't work. And I think that's exactly the case. It cannot work. Identity politics is ripping these categories, the category of the scapegoat, the category of the irredeemable one, the deplorables, right? This is like original sin. It's ripping it out of Christianity and trying to come up with a whole new scheme by which we can move from stain to purity. And that's what identity politics is all about. That's what woke capitalism is all about. It's, you know, these white heterosexual men who have this blot of stain on them because of who they are, and so they have to endorse all these movements. The way I put it in the book, it's actually an Old Testament reference, every single day the white heterosexual man in America has to involve himself in some sort of Passover ritual. And you remember the Passover moment in the Old Testament was, in order for death not to come near, you have to put a sign of innocence on the lintel of your door. And so every white heterosexual male has, in order to avoid social death, has to put some sign of his innocence. I endorse this group, Black Lives Matter, whatever. This office is green. You see this everywhere, this desperate attempt to put some sign of innocence on your door so that your stain is covered over. I mean, we have to see the current moment as a profound distortion of religious insights from the Old Testament and the New Testament.
As I listen to that, the question that comes to my mind is, why the fixation on identity politics particularly and not some other set of stains or some other set of criterion for who the impure ones are that need to be purged. You know, you think about history, we had Watergate, and then after that we went through, we had a huge conflict with the Soviet Union. So there's the ideology of communism that could have been, you know, the stain. You know, we had more scandals in the White House with Bill Clinton as we went on. So those could have created some sort of idea of stain and impurity. How did it latch onto identity politics rather than some type of, I guess, vice virtue dichotomy where, you know, it's latching onto something that Christianity would kind of say, yeah, that's deplorable behavior right there.
Well, let me see if I can. So I'll put it this way: there's a if the Genesis story is correct, that is to say, if Adam and Eve demonstrate the greatest human problem, then which is to say, there's a fault that we're involved in, and we look outside of ourselves to identify the cause, then this tendency of human beings to look outside themselves for some account of how we can get to purity is universal. So you remember the story, of course. You know, first God asks, you know, Eve, what happened? Well, the serpent made me do it. And then he turns to Adam and he says, well, what about you? And he says, it's quite a hilarious line, the woman that you gave me, God.
Right.
Right. God, it's your fault. It's not mine. And I've always been fascinated by this passage, but as I grow older and I look around at civilization, I see this is a universal disposition. There's some internal fault here, and in our response to it is to blame others. Now, why am I saying this? Because then throughout human history, we have this temptation to identify some external cause. So with Marxism, it was those dirty capitalists, and if only we could see the innocence of the proletariat. So there's this temptation to do this throughout human history. But my point is that Christianity has always been good at attenuating this, at reminding people that actually you're not going to solve your problem by looking out there. This has got to be, you have to recognize the darkness of your heart, in your heart, and you have to recognize that through Christ or through his vicegerent, through the church, this is the only way you're going to solve the problem. So as Christianity then recedes, and it has, I think, since World War II in America, the problem doesn't go away. The need to figure out the answer to the problem of purity and stain. But we less and less have the Christian resources to do this. That's why we have a kind of metastatic cancer right now in our civilization. So the Marxists, yes, the Marxists identified those mean capitalists as the problem, but every Christian in America knew that that wasn't adequate because the real problem is not out there with this group of people. But when Christianity fails, or when it falters, rather, then this Adamic impulse and this Eve impulse to blame others shows up in, you know, as a kind of cancerous growth, and that's where we are today.
Go ahead. I was going to say, you identify the scapegoating mechanism, where the current target is, seems to be white, heterosexual males. What happens when the movement of identity politics depletes the supply of white heterosexual males? Where does it go? Where does it move to next?
That's what's so incredibly interesting. So let's step back and understand this theologically first. So the divine scapegoat has infinite reservoir, so to speak, so that every human being that comes along for all of human history is able to count on the divine scapegoat. But that's not the case when you move into identity politics. Because you need the scapegoat, and Christianity understands you need the scapegoat. But here's the question. When you make this a worldly thing, and you say, no, the scapegoat is someone out there, so what happens, your question is the right one to ask, what happens if you succeed? What happens when you finally, you know, humiliate men, you get rid of their toxic masculinity, you know, heterosexuality is now, you have conscience against it, so to speak, that no one is willing to be involved in the sin of heteronormativity, to use the word on the left that's used.
Right. You know, I had to look that one up. I had to look that word up. I didn't even know what it meant.
It's a wonderful word, because it calls into doubt the idea that men are men, and that, you know, men want women. And this is where we are on the far left. So let's follow this through. So let's assume that you actually succeed in purging or humiliating or silencing men. And, of course, we know that there's a growing generation of young men who have just completely withdrawn. They have gone into the video universe. They are just nowhere to be found.
Right.
There's no, you know, women to protect. There's no wars to fight. There's no grand nation to defend. You know, there's no place for men now, and the future is female. So, but let's follow this through. So once you purge men, you still have the theodicy question, which is the question of evil, right? So you've purged these men, but because of this problem that's already there in Adam, namely there's some stain in our heart, you're not going to turn to Christ. You didn't turn to Christ when you're looking at men to solve the problem. Now you have to find another group. And so who's the next group? I mean, that's really the interesting question. Once you purge the white heterosexual male and you need a scapegoat still, and it's not a divine scapegoat, who do you look to? And I think the next group is white women. It's already starting to happen with this Karen meme. I don't know if you're familiar.
Horrible.
Yep. But
think about this. This is the beginning of the argument that the now that we've purged white men, now we have to find a new scapegoat. So it's going to be the white heterosexual woman. But now here's where it gets interesting. So what happens after she's purged? And my argument is the next group to go, the next group to be put on the chopping block, is going to be black heterosexual males. And, you know, the commitment to the family and to churches in black society, to use a term that, you know, it's not comprehensive. I mean, black is not one, it's many, because all these groups are very pluralistic, but the family matters. I mean, what separates the cause of black America from all the other causes that came after it, feminism, gay rights, transgender rights, is that what slavery did was it deprived people of the family. And so really the great wound in America is slavery. And what's happened, we have to be clear, is that feminists then piggybacked on this movement. It used what I call the black template of innocence. It piggybacked on that movement and said, as civil rights goes, so too do women's rights go. And then it went to, as civil rights goes, so too do women's rights go and gay rights go. And now it's one further extension, transgender rights. So let's follow this through. So if you believe in transgender rights, then you're going to accost and try to scapegoat anyone who believes in heteronormativity, the idea that male and female are a natural category because it's not sufficiently inclusive. This is the argument. I understand the argument quite well. But then the question is, okay, so who are the people that you have to scapegoat? Well, you have to scapegoat all those people who believe in the so-called heteronormative family, who are being exclusionary. Well, that next group happens to be blacks who believe in the church and believe in the family. And so the irony here is that the template of innocence gets started in the civil rights movement when suddenly a Shelby Steele writes beautifully that somehow this contrived innocence that America had about the race issue in America became visible on our TV sets in the 1960s. What happens is you keep moving outward and finding more and more groups that have become invisible, but then to make them visible, you have to then purge the earlier groups. And so you're finding, interestingly enough, even feminists are coming under attack by the transgender rights group, because feminists believe, many of them believe, that male and female was a natural category. They just thought that there was an imbalance. But if you're really going to push the transgender argument, you're going to say these aren't natural categories. These are all socially constituted, and anyone who believes that they're natural categories has to be purged. That's why J.K. Rowling has come under such great fire for merely stating that she believes that male and female are natural categories. So the irony here is that the group that starts the whole thing, blacks, end up being purged by it because they believe in the heteronormative family and in the homophobic church. I mean, this is the perversion of all this. But it also, I'm going to add one more thing. I think it also points to how the whole thing finally ends, which is that you keep going farther and farther out in search of innocent groups, and then the earlier groups who were initially making claims against the predominant culture end up being the enemies too. You can never be woke enough in identity politics. Mm-hmm. This is the problem. And so it does implode, but the question is, what kind of collateral damage does it do to a society before it implodes? And that's my worry. I don't know how much farther this can go. But I say, I've written this in print in several places, Black America now has more moral authority than it did in the civil rights movement, because it alone can say to this identity politics movement, no. You cannot use this template of innocence that derives from the civil rights movement that pertain to us and extend this all the way to the transgender movement. This must stop. Because all of these other groups ultimately rest their moral authority on the black template of innocence.
We're talking with Professor Joshua Mitchell of Georgetown University, and we are talking about his book, American Awakening. And the American part of that is kind of where my questioning goes, and also sort of the historical uniqueness of this moment. Do you see any parallels in history? Do you see any places or times that something like this has happened in the past, or is this sort of uniquely American for the late 20th century, early 21st century that we're experiencing now?
Well, as we talked about earlier, America has had these moments of great awakening. They're episodic. They're forms of enthusiasm where you completely lose your mind. In that sense, we're losing our minds now because everybody's desperately searching for ways to be innocent. So America has had these periodic explosions. And I guess one of the questions would be, why does it happen in America in this way? And we mentioned Tocqueville. Tocqueville has a very interesting theory about this. He says, look, human beings have this twofold nature. They have this spiritual nature and they have this material nature. And the problem with America is that you, unlike in Europe, where you still have some sense of hierarchy, of status, of class, I mean, it's disappearing, but he's writing in the 1830s. He says in America, everybody doesn't know where they stand in society. And so you develop this thing called middle-class anxiety. And everywhere I go around the globe and I describe this, it turns out everybody in the world has middle-class anxiety. What is it? It is to have tasted the goods of the world enough so that you know of their benefits, but not be secure enough in them so that you don't fear losing them. So Tocqueville thought that this new middle-class nation was going to have this huge anxiety, and that would drive their attention to the material world. And this would go on for so far, but he says because human beings have this spiritual and material nature, the more you push in one direction, the more there'll be this extraordinary snapback in the other direction. So this is Tocqueville's account of why Americans move back and forth with blazing speed between a perverse fixation on the material world, and then suddenly they discover this spiritual aspect. And of course, in the spiritual world, they're raising the question that a moneyed economy can't really address, which is, in this invisible world where we're never quite sure what's pure and stained, how do we find our way out of it? And in the past, you had Christian accounts of this. I mean, people searching for purity, searching for redemption. But we don't do it now that way. What we do is we say, I'm going to turn away from dirty fossil fuels to clean green energy. So the cleanliness that we achieve is not through Christ's salvation. It's through renouncing our 8-cylinder cars and buying a Tesla. It's unbelievably twisted. But this Tocqueville's account is that America goes back and forth between these moments of complete fixation on the material world and then this other spiritual fixation on purity and cleanliness. And I think we're in one of those moments.
So Professor Mitchell, how do we counteract this? How do we as Catholics work in this world to try to counteract this sort of new woke religion, for lack of a better word, that's happening in our midst?
So it's a great question, and I think the answer can be found if you look to Eastern Europe. So think about what's happening in Europe right now. You've got, Western Europe, with the exception of France, largely fallen Protestants, and in Eastern Europe you still have a very strong Catholic Church. So let's follow through on the thesis. So in Western Europe, you had the stains, as it were, of colonialism, of World War I, of World War II, and the Holocaust. Well, now if you still have Christianity, you know that you have to atone and repent for those things, but that through forgiveness and through atonement and through repentance, you have a tomorrow. Tomorrow is possible. This is the brilliant insight of Christianity, that this broken creature man has a tomorrow as a way of lifting the ever-growing weight of stain and guilt that he feels through Christ and through the Church. But now if you close that option off in Western Europe, which is basically what's happened because nobody is willing to go back to the churches, you still have this weight of guilt from nationalism, from colonialism, from two world wars and the Holocaust. And the bargain that Western Europeans have made with the European Union is the way that we will lift the burden of guilt from our shoulders is not through the Church. It's not through repentance and atonement. It's by renouncing the nation. So the great project of Western Europe, of these fallen Protestants who have no way to go back to the Church, is to renounce the nation. And that's what they're doing. I've been at conferences in France where prominent German political officials have said out loud to the entire group, Europe will never return to the nations again. Because Germans especially have this haunting guilt about World War II, which they can't get rid of except by renouncing the nation. But then look at Eastern Europe. You've got Eastern European nations who are still sufficiently Catholic to be able to answer Western Europeans who say, you must renounce your nation because of guilt. And they say, no. We know where guilt is to be solved. It's in the churches. It's not by renouncing our nations. So in the European nations, which are still strongly Catholic, they are perfectly prepared to support their nation because they know that the problem of guilt can't be addressed by renouncing their nation. And so this has been my answer to both Protestants and Catholics. This is not going to be solved by either having Joe Biden or Donald Trump or anyone in the White House. This is not a political problem. We're in the midst of a profound religious crisis, and the only people who can pull this back from the abyss are church leaders and lay people within the churches who go to their church leaders and say, you must now step up and speak to the divine scapegoat, speak to the problem of man's brokenness, and remind America as a whole that you're not going to solve this problem of purity and stain by scapegoating other groups. That's what Christians must do, and that's what Christian leaders must do, and I'm not seeing enough of it. I see a little of it. I'm told it's still alive and well in the black churches, but I look at the mainline Protestant churches, and I don't see much of this at all. I look at what's happening at least in some of the Jesuit universities, and I will say this true of Georgetown as well. And it's very much a kind of watered-down social justice identity politics hybrid with very little discussion of how through the church alone that we can address the problems of the world. So the churches really have to step up, and I think the lay members of the church have to press their leaders and say, why are you not speaking of this? Instead, what's happened is that the churches believe that they can solve the problem of purity and stain by endorsing Black Lives Matter, by worshiping the color of a skin. I mean, this is idolatry. And the churches must step back from this abyss.
Well, we're speaking with Professor Joshua Mitchell, who's given us some fantastic insights through his comments on drawing from his new book, American Awakening, Identity Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. And if I could, I'd like us to, I want to draw a little bit from part two of your book. It's titled Bipolarity, that's easy for me to say, and Addiction. Could you tell us a little bit about what's going on in part two of your book on this bipolar oscillation that we seem to be experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, the identity politics piece is probably going to get me into most trouble in America.
But that's okay. We'll be in trouble with you.
Okay. But the other two pieces are just as provocative. I'll speak to both of them. So after I wrote the identity politics section, I realized that even if you solve that problem, America really has some other very profound problems that have to be addressed. And the first one, as you know, is often treated today as a problem of brain chemistry. And I want to be very careful here. I'm not suggesting that if people have been diagnosed with manic depression or bipolarity that they go off their medication. These medications are necessary as supplements. But Tocqueville saw in the 1830s that there would be something very peculiar about this democratic condition that would lead to madness, he said. And so we have to figure out what exactly that meant. Well, he said that as you break the links that hold us to one another, hold us to the generations, tie us to nature, as you break those links, you get this lonely, isolated individual who then at one moment senses himself to be all-powerful because there's no constraint on him. And on the other moment, because there's no constraint on him and he is alone in a mass of civilization, a mass sea of humanity, to use Tocqueville's language, feels himself completely impotent. And Tocqueville's phrase for this is the following: I see a time in the future where men will see themselves to be greater than kings and less than men. He didn't say or less than men. He said and less than men. And so the way I characterize it in some of my other work, and I think it's in the book as well, is that we produce a configuration of what I call selfie man and management society. So everybody's taking selfies around the globe, and the world itself is a background for me. By the way, I've never taken a selfie in my life, and I never will. So you have, on the one hand, yes, it's really a terrible thing. On the one hand, you know, everybody is elevating themselves. So they have their Facebook pages, and by the way, I give a lecture called Facebook is Death to my students. We have this social media world where we're the center of the universe. So we feel ourselves to be absolutely empowered to say and do whatever we want, which is why social media is such a horrible venue for civilized conversation, because people will never meet and they say horrible things to one another. Mm-hmm. So that's on the one hand, where we feel ourselves to be greater than kings. And then, you know, I'm all for being environmental stewards. I think that's our most important task. That's why I live on the Eastern Shore. But I don't believe in environmentalism, and I don't believe that the mechanism that the left wants to use to address climate changes, which is, say, the Paris Accords, is a particularly good one. So as soon as Donald Trump pulled away from the Paris Accords, people concluded that the planet is going to die. Well, this is really a remarkable conclusion, because, in effect, what they're saying is, you and I are impotent to do anything. This is the less than men part. We have to hand everything over to the global managers. There has to be global coordination because you and I aren't up to the task. So you get this very strange oscillation back and forth in the souls of millions of people, where they're flashing pictures of themselves as if they're the most important person in the universe. And then with respect to doing anything collectively, they're not up to the task. They have to hand it over to global managers. So you get this oscillation back and forth, this bipolar oscillation back and forth. And Tocqueville's answer to this was the only way we can attenuate this bipolarity, because human life is always going to be somewhat broken and dis-ease. You can make it better, Tocqueville thought, by having all of these face-to-face associations. And by this he meant strong families, strong churches, strong neighborhoods. It's only when we build a world together with one another where we relink and build a world in common that we can avoid this oscillation back and forth. So instead of being sovereign, selfie selves and turning everything over to global managers at a level that's 50 levels above the nation or above the local community, rather, let's instead come together and build a world in our local communities. And you mentioned Patrick Tamin while we were off the air. I mean, this is Patrick's main point, is that somehow liberalism has gone so astray, we've lost sight of embodied, incarnate life at the local level. And this is a profoundly Tocquevillian insight that Patrick has, and I think it's absolutely the right one. And so we're going to suffer from this bipolarity until we come back to this embodied, incarnate life with our neighbors and face-to-face associations.
And that's
the bipolarity part.
Yeah, and I see very clearly that that's a place where the church can very much step in and take a leadership role in reestablishing to a certain extent those connections with the local community institutions, and kind of help to facilitate that sort of regrowth. Well, we are talking with Professor Joshua Mitchell. We are coming up kind of towards the end of our time here, Professor Mitchell. If people are interested in a little bit more in you, in your work, where would they be able to go to find out more about you and also to find your book, American Awakening?
So I will say I have zero social media presence because, even though I should, I'm sure, for marketing purposes, but I have zero social media presence. Because I really do believe in face-to-face associations. That said, I think Barnes & Noble has the book, and I know it can be found on Amazon, and so I'd be delighted if people buy the book and talk about it, because I do think that we have to start thinking about our problems as religious problems. Tocqueville, again, last thing, Tocqueville did think that religion was the deepest phenomena in human life. And if religion starts faltering and falling away, we're not going to get politics right. We're not going to get anything right. And so there has to be an awakening, and that's what I say in the preface, is that the book is titled American Awakening in two senses. On the one hand, we're having this false awakening to religion now, but the antidote to it is going to be a proper reawakening to this deep religious tradition that we have, and which I don't think we can depart from without destroying our civilization.
Well, this has been profoundly informative and insightful. I can't thank you enough for coming into the Catholic Cave, Professor Mitchell, but also for writing this book. This book is fantastic. And Mark, this is going to make a great stocking stuffer.
It will. It you know, it's a hardback and it's good quality, so it might not quite fit in my stockings. But Tim, I know the size stockings you've got, so it
I'm
might.
I'm kind of a man of Chesterton proportions.
Yep. So it might fit in your stockings.
Right. Well, the other thing I'll say about that, I also like about the book, just from obviously the content's phenomenal, but you took the time to number the paragraphs, so it's really, I love the way, like in the epilogue, for example, when you're kind of summing things up for us, you're able to point right back to specific parts and numbered paragraphs within the book. So it's easy to kind of pull this out because it's very accessible read. And it really, again, it really explains it. It reminds me when I came across algebra, my first algebra, I couldn't make sense. I knew there was something true about it, something good here. Couldn't make sense. And then it clicked. And that's how I felt about reading your book, Professor, is that it's like, there's something in the culture I can't quite grasp it or take it, whatever. And then your book came along and now our conversation. Again, we can't thank you enough for what you're doing. We got to have you back real soon because we didn't even talk about how, like, the pandemic has maybe exacerbated what you've already begun to chronicle in the book, and there's tons more. So thank you for this, and we'll have you back very soon.
That would be wonderful, Tim. Great to talk with you and Mark.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith, All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And we just got done talking to Professor Joshua Mitchell about identity politics. And that was a wide-ranging conversation about identity politics.
I bet we only covered maybe half his book.
Exactly.
Too.
But, you know, the interesting thing is it really covers identity on both sides of the spectrum. So on the one hand, we've got the identity politics and the new religion, as Professor Mitchell described it, of scapegoating those who are viewed to be impure or really honestly the troublemakers, the sinful mm-hmm. ones within our society. But the cause of that is an identity crisis that we have because of a lot of factors. And we touched on it at the end. A lot of factors that lead us to really honestly look of where are we going to reestablish our identity, because we've created this culture where we're ultimately, I mean, he talked about it being bipolar, but at the root of that, there's a narcissism where we have to kind of create ourselves. So we have to always be creating ourselves through what we say to others, who we interact with, what we put on Facebook. And that has to be reinforced by the people around us. And if they're not going to reinforce it, we have to get rid of them. And so all of that, I think, plays into the religion of woke, as he was describing it.
Yeah, I really found our conversation with Professor Mitchell incredibly helpful, because again, there's something profoundly wrong in the culture, and I think he's really put his finger on much of it. And that book kind of lays out kind of three different things that are going on. Identity politics is obviously one of them, because one of the profound problems that I see with identity politics, and Professor Mitchell had touched on it, is it engages in what I would call group warfare. In other words, it throws us into a kind of collective that's identified, has a certain identity to it, and it's pitted one against the other. The other thing we didn't get to though. We have to have him back. I wonder how much he may have drawn from or be familiar with Rene Girard.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there's so much there that we sort of mentioned and just. Sort
we didn't
of
have enough time. We need the 4-hour Catholic Cave.
Right, exactly.
Well, we have Professor Mitchell, someone of his caliber.
Right, and one of the things that Rene Girard brings up is what starts as this sort of all against all. Mm-hmm. conflict to try to get rid of the stains, the impurities within society, quickly coalesces into an all against one.
Yeah.
And that's where you wind up with the scapegoat. And that's what Professor Mitchell was saying is what's happened in society is that all against all of impurities, where people are no longer Christian. They can no longer figure out.
But
they know there's something wrong that has coalesced into, identity politics, where it's identifying white heterosexual males as the one, and it'll move, right? And that was right. Kind of the second.
Well, that's
part
what I'm
of
saying.
Point.
Eventually, you run out of them, or you've purged them. You've right. been successful, and then it's going to have to move to someone or something else.
Right, right. And, you know, I think he's exactly right. The root of that ultimately is rooted in our loss of faith collectively as a society. And not only just the loss of faith individually, but the reaction to that by so many in churches and also, unfortunately, in the church to a certain extent, where rather than going back to the central idea that we find our dignity, we find our identity, we find who we truly are in through the image and likeness of God in which we've all been created, we've lost sight of that. And now we're looking around for where do we find our identity? Where do we find our sense of self? And that's led to all sorts of evils and all sorts of ills.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this edition.
Wait, I got a lot more to say, Kent. A lot more.
Well,
give out my cell phone number so someone can call me. I can keep going.
You're
going
to have to hold that till next time.
All right.
Or put it on your Facebook page.
Right.
That is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. For Mr. Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.